Thanks for joining us today for another Ag Perspectives podcast. I'm Ron Hayes, and joining us today, Senior Vice President for Governmental Affairs for the National Cattlemen's Beef Association in their Washington, D.C. offices, Ethan Lame. We talked with Ethan earlier in the month of November during the National Association of Farm Broadcasters annual meeting in Kansas City, talking about a variety of topics, including the elections, what that means for the House and Senate Agriculture Committees, Frank Lucas going back on the Ag Committee, a lot of other things that are happening right now in Washington as we wrap up the old year and look into the new year. We start, first of all, talking about the elections of 2022, the midterm elections, and what they may mean for the cattle business.
Yeah, that's a big question. How much time do we have in this broadcast? You know, it feels like we're on day seven of Election Day still. You know, we're still looking at some of those races. It would appear at this point that Republicans are over the finish line as far as control of the House, but just barely. Mm-hmm. Nowhere near some of the totals that were predicted. You know, it's been interesting to talk to some of our friends in the campaign community, talk about some of the polling data. The polls weren't necessarily inaccurate, but, you know, I think some of the predictions based on the polls, you know, saying, gosh, we're going to plus on this because it's a midterm. I think people got a little bit exuberant with where they thought this thing might go. But it has been really interesting for us to look at those candidates that did perform well. And by and large, in the ag space, you know, we did see a couple losses. Tom O'Halloran from Arizona on the Ag Committee lost his seat to Eli Crane, who we had a chance to talk to during the lead up to Election Day. Kind of had a little bit of a dialogue with him. And then you had Abby Spanberger on the other side of the country in a very similar kind of race who held on. And you know, it does kind of beg the question of candidate quality. And that's not making a judgment on either of those candidates, but I think we've heard Mitch McConnell talk about that. We've heard others talk about that. I think that's going to really be where a lot of people's heads are going to go now. What does a winning candidate look like moving forward? What have we learned about where voters are today? What's their understanding of the issue set? And you know, what's working to connect with them? And even on individual ballots in some of these states, we saw real splits in those returns. You know, I mean, look at the governor's race in Georgia was called by, 10:30 at night, and we're not going to know the results of the Senate race there until early December. And it really has been an odd election cycle that way, but it is going to mean quite a few changes for the Ag Committee. I think first and foremost, that pressure on Leader McCarthy that we're hearing about this week, the debate amongst him and the Freedom Caucus and how much authority he's going to sort of give up in order to become Speaker to the Freedom Caucus. The biggest impact that might be felt from that could very well be farm bill negotiations next year. When you talk about that kind of fiscal conservative tone that we're going to hear from this new group coming in, we know some of these members are coming to Washington having sort of stridently said, I'm not voting for a farm bill. You know, we're going to see just how serious they are about that when their constituents start calling and telling them they want them to vote for a farm bill. But that could really be where we see that dynamic play out in the short term is what does that farm bill negotiation really look like?
And a lot of folks have talked about this could be close to a $1 trillion farm bill in 2023.
Well, I think it has to be simply to keep up with the cost of these programs coming out of the last farm bill. You know, with the inflation impacting everything in the country, there's nothing in that farm bill package that's immune from that, right? Whether it's the cost of food, whether it's the cost of conservation programs, whether it's the cost of FMD vaccine bank implementation, you name it. If it's in the farm bill, it costs more than it did 5 years ago. So, you know, when we talk about a flat farm bill, when we talk about flat, you know, zero baseline spending, we're really talking about $1 trillion, not $800 billion anymore, just to keep up with those programs. So it is going to be it's going to be difficult. And I appreciate incoming Chairman G.T. Thompson's approach to this, where he said, look, nothing is just automatically getting a haircut. We're not just going to sacrifice programs here. We're going to talk through this and figure out what makes sense to make sure these priorities are addressed. That's the right way to think about this. But he's got a lot of work ahead of him with a conference that may not be altogether too interested in writing a $1 trillion check after the last couple of years.
And, of course, from our part of the world, it does appear that Congressman Lucas will be back on the House Agriculture Committee. He says he has that letter of assurance from leadership that he'll go back on full seniority and be right there with GT.
Boy, and I think that's going to be a really helpful addition. I mean, of course, Congressman Lucas knows this playing field as well as anybody. He's had to ram a tough one across the finish line in overtime, and he understands this playing field for getting a farm bill done. I think he will be a fantastic resource for Chairman Thompson coming into this, and we're sure excited to see him back in that conversation. I mean, there's just a very few people in Washington that are as good a friend of the cattle industry as Frank Lucas is, and we're excited to have him back in this arena.
You mentioned, obviously, we're talking 2023 Farm Bill. What are your priorities? What are you hearing from your producers? Obviously, you'll get more of a conversation in early February when they come together in New Orleans. But what's the indications that you've got about what you want to see in a Farm Bill?
We've got a pretty good idea coming out of our summer business meeting. You know, we're going to continue our focus on holding together some of those programs coming out of the last Farm Bill, not the least of which that vaccine bank for foot and mouth disease, making sure that is funded and growing. You know, that's 4 years in now to building that bank out. They have a lot more work to do, and we need to make sure that we don't lose ground on that, especially as we see new needs, right? Whether it's increased risk of African swine fever, you know, lumpy skin disease, some of these other things that we're seeing crop up, not that they're not important too, but we need to make sure we continue to make progress on that front. Risk management for producers has become a really big issue around the country. Cow-calf producers are asking for more tools. We're seeing increased use of the tools that are there, dramatically increased use of those tools like LMR, PRF, and others. So I think there's going to be a lot of discussion around some of those tools. Conservation programs are always a big part of that discussion, although the impact of all that IRA, that Inflation Reduction Act spending back in the summer, that, you know, depending on who you talk to Chairwoman Stabenow, and she says, gosh, this is going to help us get a farm bill passed that we did these, you know, tens of billions of dollars in ag conservation spending up front. We'll see whether that's true or not. There's going to be more work to be done there as well, and that's certainly something that remains at the top of cattle producers' lists, is keeping those voluntary incentive-based conservation programs going in a way that is really useful for them to kind of keep the needle moving in the right direction. You know, we have our climate goal of being climate neutral or climate positive in this industry by 2040. We think we're going to hit that early, and a lot of these programs in the Farm Bill provide the necessary resources and tools to make that happen. So we need to make sure those are adequately funded and moving in the right direction.
I know that you've got some things that you wanted to see done either within that Farm Bill, but even before that, if you could make that happen. Some of these tools that have been talked to go out a great deal here in 2022 when it comes to the market especially.
Yeah, you know, and the market conversation is one that continues. You know, I think we're in a much different place than we were a couple of years ago when this thing really fired up. But we're in the middle of this pilot program implementation for the cattle contract library right now. That's certainly something that has captured a lot of attention. You know, just how much information does USDA need? Where do they get it from in order to give producers a really good look at, you know, what kind of deals are out there, what other producers might be securing in their negotiations with packers, and honestly, where the money's being made. And that's the thing. And looking at the pilot dashboards that they've put together that I took away from it is, gosh, you know, you can look at those grid lines and you can figure out pretty quickly, maybe here's where I adjust my operation or lean into genetics or do some other things to get after some more of those premiums that other producers are clearly benefiting from. That's going to be a really important tool, I think, for producers around the country. We appreciate USDA sticking with that. We're not there yet on quite how that needs to look to make sure we protect producers' privacy. Right. You know, I mean, USDA is a government agency, and as such, you know, they tend to default to give me as much information as possible, and we just don't necessarily believe that they need every private business detail of every cattle producer in the country in order to display some information on what contracts look like. Right. So we'll continue to work with them on that, but we think their heart's in the right place, and we're looking forward to seeing what that finished product looks like.
I guess one of the biggest pieces of the puzzle that we simply have not gotten across the finish line yet, mandatory price reporting.
Yeah, and you know, I think for the time being anyway, we're going to see that continue to ride these waves of continuing resolutions, and that's no way to govern, but it sure is the tool they use for a lot of these different programs. We would love to see a full 5-year reauthorization so we could just step away from this, you know, cliff that we find ourselves on. Mm-hmm. And you know, current Chairman Scott, I know, is looking at some ways to do that. His bill, which, you know, he's having a hard time finding support for, the Small Family Farmer and Rancher Relief Act, I think he's talked about that as a potential, you know, vehicle or some other things to potentially look at a 5-year reauthorization. I'm hopeful that as we get into the new Congress and kind of have a chance to hit the reset button, you know, if there's some bipartisan agreement that it's time to go ahead and get that done, maybe that's something we can work on next year. We would sure like to do that.
The overall mood of the industry. I mean, obviously, we've got a huge amount of herd liquidation right now. There's a lot of pressure out there. Still, a lot of that, I guess, maybe distrust of what's gone on with the whole pricing situation from the pandemic. That's shaping a lot of these conversations, I know.
Well, yeah, I think the distrust thing is a big issue. And you know, after the last couple of years, producers don't know where the next hit's going to come from, right? We see prices finally start to recover. We see them maybe recover, you know, faster than we would expect because of that herd liquidation. And then you have input costs come in and take that profit right back out of the transaction again. And it's disheartening, I think, for a lot of producers around the country that feel like they've done everything right. They've gone to seminars. They've worked on their genetics. They've improved their herds, and they're making more on their cattle, and they're still not making a profit. Mm-hmm. So I think continuing to find some ways to increase that. I was just in Idaho and heard a really good presentation from the folks at AgriBeef that are doing that True West beef plant that's opening fairly soon in Jerome, Idaho. Some of those business models and those new packing plants that are much more sort of producer focused, that are really working with producers to make sure more of that beef dollar gets back to the ranch gate. It was cool to see the reaction from the producers in the room, hearing about that, seeing some of those opportunities, seeing their marketing focus. And I'm hopeful that we're going to see some more new facilities and new business models like that cropping up around the country as a result of this billion-dollar processing capacity investment. You know, every ag economist in the country and any of them that are listening to this are going to call me and say, don't say we need more hooks. You know, we've got plenty of hooks now with the contraction. And that's true, but do we have the right hooks around the country? Do we have the right mix? Do we have enough diversified options for producers to market into so that they feel like they have choices? And I think that's where our focus is right now, is not necessarily just plus, 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 but how do we diversify that offering regionally as well as, you know, in size and kind of marketing niche? And I think that's where USDA is putting their focus too. We were encouraged by some of the grants that they put out in this most recent round. They're focusing on those smaller operations that can offer some of those new options for producers. So we're going to keep pushing down that road, and we think that that's going to be a good avenue to work on regardless of what we see with the herd size and some of those other dynamics.
I guess, are you pretty pleased with what's gone on as far as the dollars that have been pushed out? Sounds like you really are kind of pleased, but seems like a lot of these dollars are for very, very, very small plants, niche plants almost, that a producer can do some own marketing of their own, straight to consumers. There's a lot of interest in the country about that.
Yeah, and I think there is some, I think there's a lot of, I don't want to call it experimentation, that's the wrong word, but, you know, let's see if some of these different models work, right? Because we know during the pandemic, direct to consumer is one of the biggest sort of explosive pieces that we saw. But, you know, in other parts of the country, and we know this, the numbers are not huge. I mean, a 100-head facility in Mississippi is a market mover for producers down there. The same is true in Southern Virginia. The same is true in parts of places like Pennsylvania and elsewhere around the country, you know, Nevada. There are areas where you can have a lot of impact without a really, really big facility. And so then the next question is, how do you keep that facility competitive with a 5,000-head facility in the middle of the country that has every efficiency, you know, benefiting them? And that connection with local consumers, keying into some of those locally raised products, making those, you know, those connections with our end users is a big part of that, and creating opportunities for producers to sell into those without having to reinvent the wheel to do it. Not every producer wants to get on Instagram and create their own brand and push that brand 24 hours a day. Some of them just want to raise cattle and sell them and make money on them, and there need to be opportunities for both. And we think some of these investments that are being made are creating, you know, a lot of different opportunities like that. And that's the goal, right? Is not every facility should be a fit for every producer, right? And it can't be, but if it's done right, producers ought to be able to look around and say, I don't like that one, I don't like that one, but that one over there fits my business model pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Let's shift gears as we kind of wrap up, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the regulatory atmosphere. How, you know, you've got a two-year kind of almost a two-year point here, the Biden administration, so you kind of know how they're settling in now for the next 2 years as we head toward 2024. How's it working out as far as dealing with EPA, with endangered species, with all these, you know, the various alphabet of agencies you've got to deal with, and their attitudes of how they're looking at what's out there for the cattle industry?
Well, you know, I mean, it's been a big shift from the Trump administration that was truly, for whatever other criticism people might offer of the Trump administration, they sat down and listened to industry, whether it's the cattle industry or any other industry you can think of. You know, they started with what do you need from us to be more successful? Mm-hmm. You know, this administration has done a really good job of outreach. They talk to us a lot, and we really appreciate that. We appreciate that dialogue. I don't know that the end product always sort of meets that same expectation. And we'll see. We know there's a WOTUS rule waiting at OMB that's going to come out any time. We know that rule is not going to be something most of agriculture or any of agriculture is going to be pleased with. We know that rule is not going to jibe with what we expect to see likely out of the Supreme Court. And you know, it's a little frustrating to see those types of conversations play out where it's like, you guys know you're going to get a Supreme Court decision that's going to counteract what you're doing. And yet you're adding further confusion to this by insisting on moving down this path while continuing to tell us how much you're going to work with producers to craft a rule that makes sense. At a certain point, you start to roll your eyes a little bit, you know, and I think that's kind of one of those things that's always going to be a little bit of a rub, you know, in an administration like this that's trying to look to a bunch of different audiences and keep a lot of different people happy. You know, we know that any time that the Biden administration is working with agriculture, they're hearing about it from some of their other constituencies. And we don't want to discount the fact that it's not easy for a Democratic administration to work with, you know, rural constituencies without getting yelled at about it from either the enviros or the animal rights wackos or any of those people on the left flank of the Democratic Party that just relentlessly harass this administration. So we want to give them a little bit of grace, you know, on this kind of stuff. But at the same time, we do have an expectation for fairness and we have an expectation for above board, you know, dialogue about this stuff. That's not where we're at really necessarily at this point on WOTUS. We'll get there. The Supreme Court is the third branch of government for a reason, right? And so we'll see what they have to say about this. That certainly isn't the only regulation that's out there, you know, percolating at the moment. We're looking at, you know, I don't know if it's part 2A and B of the GPSA, you know, Packers and Stockyards Act rulemaking. Continuing to see that move through the system. They've been pretty busy over at USDA. We still haven't seen traceability rules, you know, resurface since the beginning of this administration. There's a lot of work to be done over at USDA still. On the interior side, we're really disappointed to see this sort of, you know, zombie-like rollback of anything ESA-related that was done during the Trump administration. Same can be said for the National Environmental Policy Act and rolling back some of that. And there's no recognition in these rollbacks of the bipartisan spirit with which they were crafted. You know, it's just the Trump administration's name is on it, so it's obviously bad and has to be rolled back. Well, wait a minute. Nature Conservancy and all these different groups were in the room for all these different, you know, discussions. If there's one thing I could criticize the Trump administration for is they had all of these groups that hated him at the table and hated us and took their input too. But that ought to be what they're seeking, right? And so, you know, I wish they would be a little bit more open to the idea that not everything that was created in the 4 years before them was garbage. And yet that's kind of where we find ourselves is fighting some of those same old battles to hold ground. And I think we'll probably spend a lot of the next 2 years doing the same thing.
So that's obviously a part of what's ahead. But for 2023, what's the early, game plan that you're trying to put your team together to focus on?
So I think first and foremost, we're going to need to do a lot of education, 60-some-odd new members up on Capitol Hill. A lot of them are new to government. A lot of them are new to the cattle industry and our needs. So I think step one is really going to be that education tour. They're going to need to get new staff in place. We're going to have new leadership in the House. We're going to have the same old dynamics, I think, in the Senate that we are all pretty exhausted by at this point, but it's kind of where we are right now. Even if the Georgia race goes to the Democrats with 51 seats, you know, we're still kind of in a little bit of a gridlock with a couple of those moderate Democrats that just aren't inclined to go with the party. Mm-hmm. So we are going to have to spend a lot of time educating. I think a lot of that, especially for industries like ours that tend to be fairly consistently from red districts, there's a responsibility there from us on our side to convey to those newly minted members of Congress that our expectation is that they get deals done, that they go to Washington and they find some common ground. That doesn't mean you step away from your principles or the principles of the people who sent you there, but there is an expectation that you go do work. You know, you're not just there to put out press releases and light your hair on fire. So, you know, I think we're going to have a lot of that conversation and helping some of these new members to understand how they can be helpful to us and how we can be helpful to them and getting messages out and doing that kind of thing and informing. So that's going to be job number one. It'll be interesting to see how the dynamic plays out between this new House, their oversight function, and the administration. I know there's a long list. All of us in Washington have kind of seen the list of potential oversight hearings, and it's growing by the minute. Since we started this interview, it's probably doubled in size. And you know, there's going to be a lot of things on there that a lot of us are going to say, don't have a hearing on that. That's not a good use of your time. You know what I mean? So I think there's going to be some of that, too, as we see how that relationship sort of develops between the administration and the House. That'll give us a better idea of kind of where our time is best going to be spent in that conversation.
Thanks, Ethan. Ethan Lane with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association out of their Washington, D.C. offices. And that is our Ag Perspectives podcast. I'm Ron Hayes on the Oklahoma Farm Report.